football season is here or near in some schools, and also back worries over head injuries. A new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association gives us more details about the brain disease CTE. That's chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Researchers examined the brains of 202 deceased football players at the high school, college, and professional levels. Boston University researcher Anne McKee and her colleagues found nearly 9 out of 10 players had CTE.
This is something that needs to be addressed, something that we need to figure out what's happening in football so that we can identify this lesion when it's first starting and try to either prevent it from getting worse or try to treat it and keep it at this very mild stage.
There are still a lot of questions about the connection between contact sports and concussion. Steve Broglio is working to answer some of those. He oversees the Neurotrauma Research Laboratory at the University of Michigan and joins me from Ann Arbor. Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
What exactly happens in a brain that leads to CTE? What are the steps that occur?
So what we believe, we don't actually know all the steps that occur, but what we believe is that when someone's hit in the head, either directly, you can imagine a helmet-to-helmet contact or a whiplash-type mechanism, there's a stretching of the brain tissue, and that releases a protein called tau, and we all have tau in our brain naturally, but it gets released out of the neuron. It changes in shape, it becomes a little bit stickier once it gets released, and then it deposits deep within the folds of the brain. So the slides that you may see on TV or on the internet or whatever with those dark stains on the brain tissue, that's the tau that's been released and then deposits in the brain tissue. And then that blocks, we believe, that blocks kind of the pathways that allows the brain to operate in a normal manner.
And is there a specific end result of CTE? Does it always result in a specific kind of damage to the brain and a specific kind of disability?
So CTE, that tau protein deposit, it is unique. The way it lays down in CTE is unique to other disorders and diseases. So it's different from Alzheimer's disease or frontal temporal dementia or other such cases. So that's what makes it unique. The clinical presentation, how people respond to that outwardly, is still much a matter of debate. And we don't have a good idea of what that looks like on the outside, which makes it very complicated to diagnose. There's no scan, there's no imaging test, blood test that we can use to diagnose CTE while somebody's alive. So we're really reliant on postmortem autopsies, very identical to what the Boston group has done to tell us if this person had it or not.
So then let's talk about what the Boston group has done and whether or not you were surprised by these results that nearly 90% out of 202 football players, and not just on the professional level, but going down even to high school, nearly 90% had some form of CTE. Did that surprise you?
Not entirely. They've done a series of work that has similar outcomes, anywhere from 90 to 95%, just depending on the sample they used. This latest paper in JAMA that you referenced earlier was just an addition, about 100 extra cases on 100 cases that they had published previously. So I'm not entirely surprised. I think what we do with this information and how we go forward is going to be very important.
Which is a good question. So let me play you this comment from GPB sports correspondent John Nelson. And he's talking about how where your school is might make a difference into how your injury is treated.
In the smaller schools that are in the more ruralized areas, you're not as necessarily as accessible to training staffs and hospital staffs. Yes, you do have ambulances that are required at every game, but sometimes even at practice, there may be opportunities or there may be situations where you don't have training staff there every day.
So as I understood it, there's not a whole lot that they can do for you for a concussion. How much does your either immediate treatment or expert treatment matter?
I think there's a fair amount that we can do. We've certainly come a long way in the last 15 to 20 years with how we manage the injury. I will say there is a dearth of athletic trainers available at high school, particularly at the high school level. I think somewhere in the neighborhood about 45% of schools in the country have access to a full-time athletic trainer. And they're the individuals on the front line that can really manage the injury. That being said, if somebody's not there, if they're not available, if an injury is suspected, you just pull them out. This is high school level. This is not national championships. This is not world championships. There's really no reason to let that kid keep playing if you have a suspicion of injury. Coach can do that. A parent can do that. So pull that athlete out and then allow them to get appropriate rest. Our thinking on rest has changed a bit in the last few years, where we used to have this kind of black box mentality put somebody in the closet, don't let them do anything cognitively or physically. Now we know we probably want them to rest for a solid 48 hours, maybe 72 hours, but then we can start progressing them back into the sport at a slow pace, and that seems to help the process along quite nicely.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Steve Broglie. He's the director of the Neurotrauma Research Laboratory at the University of Michigan. So then, Steve, let me play you this comment from NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, who was speaking to ABC News last year about how the league is responding to concussions.
I think when you look what we've done over the last 10 years, we've had 40 different rule changes that are all designed on making the game safer. We've invested in equipment changes that we're seeing, safety changes to the turf, which I think will help on impacts, including head impacts on the turf. So all of these things are going to take hold, and they take time.
What do we know about how equipment affects this? I remember reading a study in which they said, actually, it's safer if you don't play with helmets at all. How can equipment help?
So I would vehemently oppose the let's remove the helmet idea. We have helmets in football for a reason. Back in the 1920s, the sport was on the verge of being banned because of the number of skull fractures and deaths that occurred on the field. So certainly our number of concussions may go down if we remove helmets, but I don't think anybody would want to trade that for deaths on the field. Helmet technology has improved quite significantly in the last 10 years. There's incredible work that's been done by the Virginia Tech Group. Stefan Duma leads that, where they are ranking helmets based on their ability to mitigate concussion risk. And with that, the industry has responded. Everybody wants to have the top-rated helmet. So they are developing and building and selling better helmets to reduce concussion risk. I don't think a helmet will ever 100% eliminate the possibility of concussion, but we can make it better for sure. I think the next question then becomes, what do we do in sports that don't have helmets? So something like soccer is a good example, where we need to think about other techniques, and maybe that's where rule changes come in. Not allowing people to raise the elbow is a good example that FIFA implemented, and that reduced their concussion risk.
So then let's talk about kids and how different the risk is for a college player or a professional player as opposed to high school. Here's a Roger Goodell again, speaking in that interview with ABC News. They asked him if he would let his son play football.
I would certainly encourage him to do it, and I would let him do it. I think there are tremendous values from playing the game of football. There are risks involved with anything in life, but what we need to do is make sure we show people how to get the most out of playing sports and do it safely.
So, I mean, clearly, if you're an NFL player, the risk of CTE is fairly high. But what about high school players?
So we don't have a strong understanding, even at the professional level, we don't have a strong understanding of what the real risk is. So if we look at this paper from the Boston Group, there's a very large selection bias, and they note that in the paper. So these are individuals that had cognitive problems at the time of death, or they died under maybe suspicious circumstances, and their bodies were donated to science or to the Boston Group so the families could have a better understanding of what happened. There's never been a study that has looked at CTE risk or rates across, let's say, everybody that played the game of football or took a sampling of everybody that ever played the game. So we don't have an understanding of what the risk actually is at the various levels of play. Now, presumably, people that play more and have more exposure, the professional athlete, are at higher risk, but that makes up a very, very small sliver of people that play football in general. The bulk of people play 2, 3, maybe 4 years of high school football and they're done. They don't have the opportunity to go on to college. And then even a smaller portion of people that make it to college make it to the professional level.
So do we know if there's a difference based on what position you play? I mean, I assume the kicker's fairly safe, but what about the quarterback? And does it matter which position you play?
I think your assumption would be my assumption as well. I think the kicker is probably the safest position on the field, other than maybe the bench warmer. but we don't have a strong sense of whether the quarterback has a different risk profile than, let's say, the offensive lineman. The reason being is, while the linemen may be involved in every play and they take more impacts to the head in total, the magnitude of those impacts, how hard they're being hit, is much, much lower than the quarterback, who, when he gets hit, it's typically quite severe. So we do not have a strong understanding of what that trade-off, fewer number of hits, greater magnitude, larger number of hits, smaller magnitude. We don't understand what that trade-off looks like in the long term.
So, I mean, we're going to take a break here in just a moment, but can we say that we have the equipment and the knowledge that we need to keep football players safe from CTE at this point?
I think we are I think we need to understand what the risk factors for CTE are. I think we are doing the things that we think are correct at this point. I don't think any medical professional is going to do anything but the best, what they feel is the best for the athlete. But we don't have a strong understanding of what causes CTE, why people get it, why some people get it, why some people don't. And I think a lot of research needs to focus in that area, and then we can start targeting those things that do result in the disease.
As Steve Broglio, he's the director of the Neurotrauma Research Laboratory at the University of Michigan. He's going to stay with us. We continue this conversation in just a few moments with a former Atlanta Falcon who is trying to change the way that kids think about football. Later this hour, we'll speak with a legendary music producer in Athens who has some new music for us. But if you have thoughts about football and brain injuries, we'd love to hear them. You know how to reach us on social media or just call us at 404-500-9457. This is On Second Thought.